Welcome, everyone, to episode 324 of After the Credits. I am one of your co-hosts, Maureen Antunes, joined today by fellow co-hosts.
Steve Stebbing.
Bill Harris.
And Melissa McDowell.
Hey!
Welcome back. Surprise!
So we're back. We're here. We're going to talk Strange Darling. We're not like... We've already been bullshitting for 20 minutes. Let's just get into the nitty-gritty.
Apologies on that.
not your fault. We had a great talk.
Yeah. Apparently it was system update time.
Oh, that explains it.
Yeah.
I think so, by this point in 2024, if people are not aware of Zoom connectivity issues, really like always technical difficulties. There's always technical difficulties.
Yeah.
Pretty much every time you have to log in, there's something that needs to be updated. But okay, let's talk about Strange Darling, J.T. Molnar's new movie, which apparently just like beat another box office thingamajig. I have no idea at this point. I don't keep track of box office numbers anymore. But thoughts?
Do we need to set ground rules for this discussion first?
Okay, I guess we should.
Do we want to be?
Well, okay, so I guess this is the thing, because I feel like you should probably have seen the movie before you listen to any discussion about it. Because I think knowing anything is kind of going to ruin it for you.
Can I just say bravo to that trailer for the biggest bait and switch maybe in movie history?
Yeah.
That's not really a spoiler, but holy shit, that is a bait and switch.
Yeah, absolutely it is. I mean, even the naming of the characters in the very beginning of the movie is a complete bait and switch too.
Okay, so I think it's before we start, I think we should just say this is going to be a spoiler-filled discussion. Yep. So you might want to, and it might not be totally spoilery, but if you don't want to know anything, which I think is probably the best way to go about seeing this movie, just check the time codes and then, you know, move on to the next item on the discussion list. But because I want to address this idea of the bait and switch, because I think it's less that and more bucking expectation, because we never really expect the woman to be the killer. Like the general feeling when you watch anything is the guy is clearly the bad guy. So, I mean, I think one of the things the movie does really, really well, and for the first 15 minutes until you get to sort of like to the realization that she's actually not innocent in this whole thing, I think that what got me was that feeling of, oh, okay, so you played me. Because my thought as a woman is always the guy is always the bad guy. And clearly you're like the general consensus is usually the guy is the one that's the bad person. So the fact that they're playing into that, like he's leaning really hard into that, plays really well for the movie.
But I don't think it's just that. I think like one of the brilliances of this film is that it throws you off balance in multiple ways. Mm-hmm. Like, first off, it starts off by saying like this is based on a true story and eyewitness accounts. All of that is baloney. This never actually happened. You've got like the names of the characters, which I think is like a stroke of brilliance because it immediately sets you up for what you've seen in the trailer. And then like the sixth chapter story told out of order. Like all of it is like really just playing around with convention and people's expectations of a film. And I feel like so rarely this surprised in a movie. And that's like, I don't know. I just love that. I love it when somebody really turns things on its head and like gives you something really unique and original. So yeah, a huge fan of this movie.
Yeah. I'm all about this movie for sure. I mean, with that Love Hurts cover in the beginning that kind of like weaves its way throughout the film. Giovanni Ribisi, I had no idea what his cinematography game was. And holy shit. Another film where it has a scene done in just like the brilliant of reds. And which is part of my thing.
It kind of looks like a giallo at times, right?
Yeah, it really awesome. Does. And just how the red pops pretty much at all times in the film. Anytime there's red on screen, it really pops. The cool blue of the date scene to kind of give you a place of comfort almost, which is very unsettling in this film. The gender norms that they're playing with is in this film is really, really great. And yeah, the the moments of real frustrated realization that happen a couple times in this film, one with Cal Gulner's character and then again with the female cop in the car, are so brilliant. I just really, really love that. And sound cues like crazy, sound cues in this. And Ed Begley likes to cook with a lot of butter, eh? Like lots, like a good amount. So
I'm actually kind of shocked we've gone like 5 minutes here without saying it was shot on 35 millimeter.
Oh yeah. And it
did,
and it's,
did we need to state that in the opening credits of the movie? Like, to me, that just seems kind of pretentious, to be honest.
Flex when you can flex.
I guess, but is that really a flex? I mean, for an indie movie, it's definitely a flex, but
I feel like Ribisi called for that.
Probably. No, actually, it's the director. I read a really interesting interview with him, with the Hollywood Reporter, and he was talking about how Giovanni Ribisi even got involved in this as a DP. And it was largely because this filmmaker was so committed to filming on 35 millimeter. Giovanni Ribisi owns a camera rental company in Hollywood. So he came with all the equipment, and it's kind of how they were able to afford to do this movie on 35 millimeter. So yeah, I thought that was like super cool. Very random.
That is interesting. But still pretentious as fuck. Yes. I'm sorry. The fact that you have this man, a male writer director, that decides that he's only going to shoot this thing on film is fucking pretentious.
Well, if M. Night Shyamalan can call the film M. Night Shyamalan's Trap, they're allowed to put 35 millimeter before the film.
I would also say, Marina, in his defense, like when he was talking about it in the interview, he was saying like he just there's something about like filming on film that to him as an artist is really appealing, and he wanted like to be able to smell the celluloid while they're filming and like doing that, like calling action and cut and doing all of that in an analog way, not on digital film. So I don't know. I appreciate nerds who want to film on film.
I'm quite honestly, I do too. I'm more than anything, I'm just being a bitch about it. That so rubs me the wrong way, because there are so many great storytellers that can't tell stories to get, like, they can't get any, like, zero funding to tell any story. And then you have people walking around Hollywood that have never really made anything of note that decide they're going to shoot something on 35 and that's all they're going to do. Like, that's the only way they're going to tell their story. And to me, that just seems ridiculous. And that's not to say that Molnar would not eventually have made this movie on digital if film wasn't an option. And I'm not saying that. I'm just being a bitch about it. I fully realize that.
Gee, man, you make it sound like he shot on 70 millimeter.
Okay, well, you know, he's not Christopher Nolan. Let him make a couple of other movies that are really good, and then he'll be Christopher Nolan saying, I'm only going to shoot this on 70.
Yeah, how did he secure all of this? With just one Chad Michael Murray movie in his hindsight.
Well, I mean, I can only assume that, you know, Ribisi probably has stepped in with some help in other ways too. Because, I mean, you don't just like call up Barbara Hershey and say, hey, can you be in my movie? I've made these movies. I mean, the role is interesting, but it's not even like particularly juicy. She's gone for most of it. She's on screen for what, like 5 minutes, if that? Mm-hmm.
But it's the Begley's always ready.
It's a great five minutes.
So, Willow Fitzgerald for Best Actress?
Damn right.
She's never going to get nominated.
I know, but like,
she's fantastic.
Incredible.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
This will be the performance that will have all the horror genre fanatics upset that she can't get nominated for an Academy Award. It's like Hereditary, right? Yeah. But she's great. I love Kyle Gallner. I'm like glad he's finally in a movie that's like legitimately successful, because he's always been in like these movies that are not like super critically acclaimed, but I always think he's really good. So it's nice to see him like actually do something that's going to get him some traction finally.
And he's pretty sinister. Like, he just looks like a guy you don't want to cross.
And I love the yellow hunter shades.
Yeah. And for all you Veronica Mars fans, you know who Kyle Gallner is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course we do. Fuck.
I
didn't recognize him by name. It wasn't until I actually saw him on screen. I'm like, oh, okay.
Where are my Haunting in Connecticut fans
exactly.
at?
Exactly. That's where I know him from. He was like the best part of the terrible Nightmare on Elm Street crew.
Yeah.
Elm Street remake.
That's true. It's true.
But leave it to Bill to bring in Veronica Mars. I love it.
I don't know. I really enjoyed Smile.
He's good in that
and
too.
He'll appear in the beginning of the sequel, which has been clocked in at 2 hours and 12 minutes long.
Fuck off.
I will say the trailer looks impressive to the point where I was like, this actually looks good. Did I even see the first one?
I have predictions for how big this movie goes.
I think it's going to make
story
money,
wise.
Man.
Story wise, I have predictions because I think we're following a pop star on stage. She kills herself on camera to millions of people around the world, putting the Smile pandemic all over the world.
The Smile extended universe.
Like, yeah,
Steve is proclaiming it.
It goes international at the end of this movie. I think what's his name? Finn Parker is going big with this one. I think Finn Parker is a very interesting director.
Any money?
Yeah, almost as good as me saying that the little girl was going to kill everybody in Trap, but I just hate children.
That would have been infinitely better than what we got.
Okay,
which was
let's talk about Trap later because I finally saw this disaster.
Shyamalan Columbo.
But okay, back to Strange Darling.
We never go off the rails on this podcast.
Never. No. Never.
Come on now. Always keeping it going.
No, but this movie surprised me. I'm excited to see it again. I think it's one that Dan might actually enjoy, even though he's always telling me all the movies we watch are either horror movies or filled with sex in this husband. Oh my gosh.
Do they ever actually have sex though?
No.
I don't think they do.
No.
And that whole consent discussion, I thought was super fascinating and really, mm-hmm. really interesting. And mm-hmm. I'm like, who did you talk to about this? Because this does not feel like something that came just out of your brain.
Yeah.
Also, they were like, what's the worst, most maybe funny, safe word we can come up with? Okay, that one will work.
Yeah, no kidding,
eh?
Yeah, that was really, I also really love when she gets out of the hotel room and the neighbors, the old man neighbors. Yeah. That's like I just love that scene because it's so funny.
That's his dad. That's the director's dad.
Oh, that's
his dad. Oh, it's brilliant. It's such a great, he's got a gun. So do I.
Yeah, not a small gun either. Like
no.
A magnum or something like that. Yeah, it's one of the best films of the year.
Yeah,
and I'd heard about it last year because it played Fantastic Fest, and one of my friends had his number one of Fantastic Fest.
Wow!
I'm like, I hadn't even heard of this film, dude. How can it be your number one film? He's like, just wait. When it opens in 3 months, I mean 11 months, you'll see it, and you'll understand. And he was completely correct.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Like, you want to tell people to watch it, but you don't want to give them anything. It's so much better to go into this movie cold. And that's impossible now because all the press that's going on around it is like the second sentence of the article gives away the entire twist to the film. So, yeah. But
it's so popular that AI bots are trying to tank it. It's because on Twitter, some of the trending things are Strange Darling earning mixed reviews. And it's like, that's not true. None of that's true.
Have you actually read or heard anybody say anything bad about this film?
No, I have not. It's all been positive, glowing reviews. Like, actually, my podcast co-host on Tremble, Kurt, gave it like a 3.5 out of 5. But I don't know. We differ in our opinions sometimes.
And 3.5 is still not bad.
Yes, it's still a positive review, I think. Like, even if I look through my letterbox, other people, like, yeah, it doesn't dip below a 3.5 from anybody.
A local critic friend of mine, Kyle Wells, gave it 2 out of 5.
What was his criticism on it?
Didn't write anything because I might have shot him.
My buddy says it stalls in the second act.
He's wrong. Yeah. Sorry.
No, I mean, I don't think I'm quite as high on it as you guys are, but still, I think it's unfair to say that the movie is not good. Because it is, and it is surprising, which, like Melissa says, is so impossible, almost impossible to do nowadays. It's so rare that we're actually like surprised by a movie. And this movie really did surprise me, because I thought, I'm like, okay, I know exactly where this is going. And then I didn't know exactly where it was going. And then I was like, well, I really don't know where it's going. So let's just go along for the ride. Cause you never really know. Like, and then thinking back on it, I'm like, okay, now I want to watch it again. Maybe reorder the parts. Can I watch it linearly now and see how it plays? Like, now I really want to see it a second time and maybe a third. So there better be some physical media for this thing, because it's gonna require rewatching for sure. And it is a movie that I will go back to on other occasions, because it is really good and it's really entertaining. Mm-hmm. Like, the time just flies.
Yeah.
Well, I felt like my heart was beating, like pounding for a large portion of this movie. Like, the tension and the pacing are so strong in this film.
The editing is exceptional. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, the fact that it plays so well, like within the sections, it's so well edited. Mm-hmm. But then when you think about it, like on a bigger picture, there are things that like clearly are edited sequentially as well. So that if you were to watch it in a different order, things would still make sense. I think that's really impressive. I'd love to see a little bit more about that aspect of the movie. I want to see the behind the scenes. Like, give me all the things about the making of this thing and then how you decided to cut it. Was this from the get-go? Clearly it was from the get-go. It was in this order, but I'm curious to see, like, I want to know all the things. All the things.
Yeah, it's probably, well, it is in my top five right now for 2024. It might be my number two movie of the year right now, actually. And VVS has it, so when it does come out in physical media, it'll be pretty cheap to pick it up.
Nice. Part of me wants her to get nominated just so we can have the scene with her in the freezer as her like scene. That'd for the yeah.
Hey, maybe it gets an indie spirit.
Yeah.
Oh, I could see that.
Maybe it's in that wheelhouse.
I could see that.
Because Giovanni will be in that conversation, I think.
Yeah.
I think
probably.
He will.
I can't really think of any other titles off the top of my head that would fit in that discussion without looking at more closely at the list of the releases for the year. But
I hate asking this question because it's such a cliched question. But does anybody know the budget?
I didn't
know. No,
sure, I don't. It didn't cost a lot. That film
was like around $4 million, I think.
That's such a good use of money.
Yeah, yeah. It has to be a lot on that house too.
Well, that's the thing. It was $4 million, but like he said, basically Ribisi coming through with all the camera equipment and everything was like adding an extra million to the budget. So like, cause they didn't pay for that. He brought it with him.
Yeah.
So I guess a $5 million movie, but like, a lot of bang.
It says four on Wiki.
Yeah.
So yeah, the donut budget of Avatar.
Pretty much.
Not even the coffee budget. It's probably the milk budget on Avatar.
Yeah.
which also milk means budget. That Barbara Hershey and Ed Begley Jr. definitely did this for scale, right?
I think everybody did.
Yeah.
And somebody didn't get, a bunch of people didn't get paid at all. So made with blood, sweat, and tears, man.
It's a good calling card.
It certainly is. It certainly is. So I think it's fair to say we all say see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
On the big screen, friends, on the big screen.
I agree. It's good. It's a fun movie to watch with a crowd. Because the girl sitting like two seats away from us, I looked over at one point and she literally like had her hands her mouth, and I'm like, okay, clearly this is playing very strongly for some people.
Yeah, and then have fun googling Electric Lady Killer after you watch it.
Sounds like a Jimi Hendrix Experience album.
It totally does.
All right, what else do you guys have? Who's been watching what?
I don't have a lot, honestly, between the last time that we recorded, but I might need to get some Vitrol out firstly with the long gestated IP revival of The Crow, which what the fuck was this movie? I mean, when you put it in the hands of the Ghost in the Shell director, Rupert Sanders, you should know that it's not going to be that good, but just nothing works about this film whatsoever. And I'm sorry, FKA Twigs, but it's either the script, the director, or it's you, because holy shit, was she bad in this film. Just horrendously terrible. Bill Skarsgård like limps his way through this entire film. Danny Houston's villain is nonsense, complete and utter nonsense. And all of the lore, did anybody watch The Crow or read the James O'Barr graphic novel like at all? Is there any tether to this whatsoever besides being a Hot Topic goth? I am so annoyed by all of this, and it was almost like they saw Suicide Squad and Jared Leto's Joker and was like, that's our Crow. So I don't know what happened. So
see, Hot Topic goth is my new favorite thing.
I don't think I hated it as much as you did, but it's still really poor.
I despised it. It was boring. It was large.
That was his main problem. Is it's just, I'm just like, what are they doing? Did they even watch this?
One big thing that bothers me, sorry to cut you off, but one big thing that bothers me is Shelley and Eric are dead at the beginning of the 1994 Crow. Like,
my question. Isn't that whole love story thing like 10 minutes of the movie?
Like clips, and only in like clips and fractured memories and stuff like that is the only way.
It's an hour.
It's a solid hour, and it's only 12 days of a romance.
Yeah.
They only spend 12 days, and all of a sudden they have this bond between life and death.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any fucking sense whatsoever.
I also wasn't terribly a big fan of the film becoming John Wick in the third act.
So bad.
Pretty terrible. FKA Twigs might be the worst performance I've seen this year, actually.
She's so bad. Horrendously bad. And it's almost like it tries to win you over with the violence at the end, but it's like, no, guys, it's too late. we're beyond this. None of this means anything. It didn't mean anything in the beginning. It doesn't mean anything now. So I don't know. Yeah.
I'm also kind of thinking Rupert looked at the Proyas film and went, I'm going to shoot it exactly in a different way that he did, and then just lost the plot. It's visually not interesting at all. It's ugly. The performances are terrible. It's way too fucking long. Yeah.
Which is terrible. Shocking, because he's actually not, like, visually, he's a really interesting filmmaker. Like, he generally makes movies that look really good. They're not usually very good, but they at least look really good.
Yeah.
There's a land, the Crow Land, we'll call it, where they go to like this purgatory like train station.
He's on fire this episode. This
looks so bad. And the way to get out of it, each time they do it two or three times in the movie, is he grabs Bill Skarsgård by the face and just shoves him in slow motion. It's like, is that the only way out of this place? That's embarrassing, man.
Yeah.
Oh, so it just laughably bad.
The really sad part about this entire thing is that the studios won't learn, and they will continue to try to monetize classic movies for like some new audience that's not even the described audience, and they don't understand what the first project was. They're like, this was popular, let's remake this, but nobody understands what it's about. Let's just try to monetize it.
I will say that I actually kind of laughed at Danny Houston's performance. I thought he was actually just taking the piss the whole movie. Like, it was,
and let's be honest, most of the time he's taking the piss out of everyone. He's general, like, the amount of movies I've seen Danny Houston in, the movies aren't great, and he's just like chewing up scenery like he's having the best meal of his life, and half the time he's not even good, but he's just there basking in it. I kind of love him for it.
Yeah, I'm sure he got paid. That's all
he got paid.
He probably got paid more than anybody on that film.
Probably.
He probably bought a new house or needed to pay a mortgage or something, you know.
He's a Houston. You have to pay a Houston. That's the way it goes. That's the Hollywood rule. I watched the bull riding movie Ride. is written and directed and starring a guy named Jake Allen. It was okay, a little cliched. It's basically resting on the performance of C. Thomas Howell, who does some really great character stuff. Like, it's about three generations of bull riders. And then Jake Allen's character is just getting out of prison. It also has 4E J. Smith, who is like the main ranch hand on Yellowstone. So it felt like every time he was on screen, I was like, am I watching Yellowstone? Oh, right. No, I'm not. I'm watching something different. because I didn't realize that there was going to be a story of faith brought into this. It comes in that third act and just takes a good old squat and shit all over everything you've been watching. And then the message becomes more important and I check out. It's just kind of the way it goes.
So no.
Yeah. It's like a mid. I gave it like a mid. Because it just, I don't know, like as a non-religious guy, you just kill my patience for a movie when it just becomes the message and it's like done. I watch a classic that I got on Blu-ray, Paris Blues from 1961. It's Paul Newman, Sidney Poitier, Diane Carroll, and Joanne Woodward. And those top three actors there, Newman, Poitier, and Carroll, drowned out Joanne Woodward, who I'm not like super familiar with her, but this is one of those classic examples of like when people are like leaps and bounds above you, then you start to drown a bit on screen. But it was weird to watch it in Blu-ray because it looks like it was filmed yesterday, but with like a Instagram filter on it. Really, really strange. But Paul Newman was just an incredible looking human being. And Sidney Poitier is like the template for Denzel, like in mannerisms and movement. Like he is such a template. And it was done by Martin Ritt, who is like just a hell of a filmmaker of that time. Did HUD and with Steve McQueen and some other ones. Really good stuff. So Lee Daniels decides to do like a possession exorcist type movie. And it's like teetering into ridiculousness for like the whole movie before the third act. It just decides like, oh, yeah, I'm a wet pile of diarrhea craziness. And this fucking movie, it's entertaining, but absolutely terrible.
Wait, what's it called? Because
it's called The Deliverance.
This is
new on Netflix. Right? Yeah, it's new on Netflix. Audra Day's performance is not bad because she's like the mother of three kids moving to a new area. They move into a house that has evil stuff in the basement that emanates from a hole in the floor, because of course it does. And apparently this is based on a true story as well. And then Audra Day's mom is played by Glenn Close. So yes, she's a mixed race. And I don't know what's Glenn Close's agent booking her these days. Like, I'm so confused.
Pay me.
Yeah, I guess so. Because between this and Hillbilly Elegy and stuff, like she's playing some really.
Okay, but Hillbilly Elegy is ancient at this point.
Yeah, that's fair. That's like 5 years, 4 years old at this point.
Is it really that old?
Yeah, I think 2020. But I think it came out during the pandemic. It still needs to be her cross to bear.
Yeah.
For doing that fucking movie.
That movie is
especially
terrible.
Now with everything we have in the news now, she really has a cross to bear on that one. Not just her. But what I will say that, because it's now trending on the internet, you'll see videos of this. Lee Daniels got Glenn Close in makeup, like in the like possessed makeup, to say in a line, "I can smell your nappy pussy." So we have Glenn Close saying that line in this movie.
Wow.
Yeah. So, And Anjanou Ellis is in this movie, and they just give her the most ridiculous lines I've ever heard, because they're like, oh, do I need to be an exorcist? And she's no, you just need to believe in Jesus and you can exorcise any demon. So but if you believe in Jesus, you can destroy demons out there. Just so you know, it's just, I don't know. Lee, when was the last truly good Lee Daniels movie? Was it Precious?
First?
Yeah. Has he done a film that was good since then? Okay.
I know. I have the real question. Was it worse than The Paperboy?
Yes. Yeah, I'm going to say it's worse than the Paperboy.
Wow.
I mean, the Paperboy had the cast going for it, if nothing
else. That's true. I read or watch Get Shorty, but still, movie's still great. Movie still fucks. I really enjoy that. And it's Travolta heyday. Like, he's so great in that one. And I'm going to end off with Blink Twice, Zoe Kravitz directorial debut. I know there's probably a lot of people that are middle of the road on this one. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really solid with some great dialogue in it. And towards the tail end of the third act, I say the best performance from Channing Tatum I've ever seen.
Ever?
Like, it's so damn good.
It's good. This is a great segue because I watched this too and I feel exactly the same. I think
he feasts.
He's amazing. Scene.
He's so good. Naomi Aki really came through in this movie for me big time. And I'm spacing on who the survivor girls.
Oh, Adriana. She's fantastic.
She's so good. Yeah, from Hitman. Yes, yeah. She's really good. And right after like the twist part where characters start to figure stuff out, there's a scene between her and Naomi Aki that I thought was just fucking great. Just so good with such good subtext to it. And again, the gender role stuff in this movie, I really, really, really dig. And ooh, the ending is just
chef's kiss.
So nice. Yeah. So nice.
Yeah, I'm with
especially
you.
Especially the way it was done. Yeah. I dig the hell out of Blink Twice. One might be one of my favorites this year, actually.
I'm with you. I thought it was really, really well done. I do have some like small quibbles with it. And it feels a lot like Get Out. I don't know why, but that's kind of the jive I got of it. That said, I mean, the fact that you have a solid actress who decides to take her hand at directing and comes up with this as her debut feature, fucking impressive. Like, she clearly has an understanding for story, for storytelling. What the stories that she's telling are really interesting. And then the movie just looks fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And yeah, Channing Tatum, this could well be the best he's ever been on screen. And I've seen all the Magic Mike movies.
I mean, I really like Dog a lot. I think Dog's one of my favorite performances. I thought Dog was really great
too. Yeah, I'm with you. I think he's also like a solid filmmaker in his own right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I really like this movie. Gina Davis just cracks me up.
What a surprise. What an absolute surprise. I had no, because I knew Christian Slater was in the cast, but I didn't know that Gina Davis was. And oh my God.
And she's just hilarious. Like, she's so good. But I mean, I think beyond that, like, some of the themes that it's getting at are really, really interesting. And that ending, besides the fact that it's played off really well, like, thematically is also really interesting. So I think the movie does have some interesting things to say. I'm glad people are digging it, if only to see Channing Tatum be an asshole.
Yeah.
I mean, the name of his character from the get-go, Slater King, doesn't get any douchier than that.
No. Actually, I also say there's some stuff from Christian Slater in near the end of the movie that I think is just hysterical stuff. And it just reminds you how great Christian Slater is. And the last thing I'll say about it is my favorite title card of the year.
Oh, yeah, I could go with that. This movie is like solid. Like, I went to see it before I met up with Melissa. I watched two good movies in a day. I feel like I'm winning the lottery, to be honest. I saw this before Strange Darling. So I'm like, I won.
So does everybody remember Marina's story about seeing Twisters?
The one about the melting screen?
Yeah.
Did this happen to you?
So guess what happened about 20 minutes into me watching Blink Twice?
Oh, no.
And it wasn't the hotness of Glenn Powell. It was the hotness of Channing Tatum, I guess.
They're both up there. They're both screen melters, all right?
Agreed.
I'm comfortable enough in my sexuality to say that those are both sexy, sexy dudes.
My screening, it started to flicker.
And
I was like, okay, that's probably not a good thing.
I should blink twice before watching this.
Yeah, so. Totally. And then this went black.
Oh,
like no green lines like Marina was or whatever, like white and all that. No, it just died. And the manager came in and was like, we can try to figure it out, but we're all not really trained on how to. I'm out.
Yeah, like, fuck this. Give me my money.
And I went and saw it again. But as Marina said about Twisters, the first 15 minutes was really good.
Nice.
Yeah.
I will finish off what my review is saying, that teasing what's going to come, because I have, I'm 15 minutes into Rebel Ridge.
I was going to ask.
Yeah, I have seen it. I have a screener for Rebel Ridge. I'm already excited for what's the guy's, Aaron, what's the lead's name?
I don't know.
Mid-sized sedan.
Yeah, I don't remember.
I don't think his name's not Mid-sized Sedan. His name was Mid-sized Sedan. Aaron Pierre. Yeah. He's the lead of the film. And it already looks interesting. Some of the douchebag cops, like you got David Deadman is one of the douchebag cops, and another douchebag cop is Emery Cohen. So I'm like, okay, we're already on a good track here. And then Don Johnson's going to be the sheriff. Okay. I'm in already. And it's already given me Blue Ruin vibes. So we're already good. And I have the screener for The Front Room. Elevation hooked me up.
Oh, so, nice.
Yeah. So, and then Beetlejuice is up next on my docket. So
nice.
That's it.
Following up on Think Twice, I watched Greedy People, which is not worth your time and effort. I'll just leave it there. This movie is so bad. I don't understand how this even got made.
Oh,
it's JPL. It's not even a comedy. Like, it's not even funny.
It's got a good cast.
It's got an amazing cast. Like an amazing cast. Hamish Patel is great. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is JGL is always fantastic. The movie is just kind of lost. It doesn't know what it wants to be. It's a comedy, but it's also like a thriller. And like 5 minutes in, it's not clear what it wants. It's just a big mess. I say skip it. It's just not worth the time and effort. Bill mentioned last episode Ghostlight, and he undersold this movie severely.
Did I now? I thought I said it was one of the best films of the year, but that's
okay. Oh, I still think it's good. It's so good. I cried at the end of this movie, and it feels so real. I think is what I really really liked about it. The performances are fantastic, and it just feels like just a real story. I don't know, something about it just really really worked for me. The performances from Keith, is it, how do you pronounce his last name, Guffiker?
Yeah, something like that. His real life daughter.
I mean, it's amazing stuff, and it's such a great story about grief, but also like really unexpected. I thought it was really really wonderful and really well done, and such just like a touching story about like family and the power of performance. Yeah. Really, I guess. Jordan Scott's A Sacrifice. I legitimately watched this because it's Eric Bana, and I will watch anything with Eric Bana in it because he's not in enough movies. Not realizing this is one of the Scott's, like Ridley Scott's daughter, who has apparently made other movies that I've never seen. So, hey, there's that too. This is okay at best. It feels like a 90s thriller. Like, that's the best way I can explain it. So Eric Bana plays a professor who is working in Europe. He's like a profiler, I kind of think. Now I'm second guessing. Who gets pulled in. He's writing a new book, and he gets pulled into an investigation as kind of like the expert, but also to do research for his next project. It turns out to be like a cult thing. I love movies about cults. Like, sign me up. I don't care what the cult is. This was so boring. I don't even know where to start. And it just doesn't make any sense. It's not a very good movie. It does look interesting. It's very... I kind of like the Eastern European slate gray look of things. And this certainly has that going for it. It's just not a very good movie. Eric Bana is wasted. I don't know what else to say. He's so good, and he's just kind of bland here.
That I ran into him on the street in Vancouver.
What? Very bizarre. What?
I was walking to work, and in front of the Fire Hall Arts Center was Eric Bana having a conversation with this guy. And I looked at him, and I had to do like a double take to realize that it was really him. And then there was another guy walking with me, and we were both like, "Is that the Hulk? Was that the Hulk?" he is even better looking in person than he is on screen.
How is this possible?
I know, but it's true.
I also,
sorry, that's my breath with fame.
I also saw that movie, and like you, I was taken by the whole cult aspect of it. I didn't think it was terrible until the third act, where it just falls apart.
It's so bad.
Falls apart.
Yeah.
And that cult leader, she's creepy as fuck. Why would people follow her? Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it works for the movie. It's just not very particularly convincing. It's just so messy and kind of boring towards the end. I was very disappointed. I want better things for Eric Bana, as far as I'm concerned.
I want better things for Sylvia Hoax, too, because she's
she's
way better than that.
She's incredible. I love her.
I saw a passing headline about a movie that was on YouTube, and I'm like, what is this thing about? So I watched Milk and Cereal, Curry Barker's 60-minute feature. I don't think at 60 minutes you're technically a feature. I think it needs to be 120 minutes, but I don't actually know what the rules are. Either way.
Like found footage too, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's a found footage horror movie written, directed, and starring Curry Barker and Cooper Tomlinson. And it is far better than it has any right to be. Let's just say that. It is very watchable. It's literally just over 60 minutes long. It doesn't overstay its welcome, which I think is one of the things it has really going for it. And the other thing it has going for it is the fact that performances are actually really good. I find one of the problems with a lot of these found footage films and a lot of stuff that just ends up online, like the performances are just bad. You just get taken out of the movie 5 minutes in, and you can't even watch them. This one is surprisingly good. Like, he's actually a solid actor. And Cooper Tomlinson gives a really good performance. It's not the greatest thing ever, but it was far better than some other shit I've seen this year that I actually pay for. So I would say this is definitely worth checking out. It's free on YouTube. You just have to watch a bunch of ads. So, hey, there's that going for it. And it is a solid calling card, I got to say. I think he's got some interesting things coming his way. And then I did watch Trap. Even though you guys had all warned me, just can't help myself. Fucking terrible. Just awful. And the thing that Dan said to me partway through, and I was like, you're so right. Have any of these people that made this movie been to a concert? Like, because why is everybody in the concourse all the fucking time while the artist is on stage? I don't get it.
Even the number one fan daughter leaves the concert partway while the concert's still going.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Like, what the fuck? Really? Like, have you been to a concert?
Some of my favorite terrible lines of the year come from Trap, though. Like, look at that trap door. We should jump down there. I fucking died.
Wow.
I had an out-of-body experience when that line happened.
When he kept looking there, I'm like, is he just going to try to sneak under there while everybody's looking at the stage? Because he kept looking around, and I'm like, maybe he's going to try to roll in there or something. And then I'm came out, and I'm like, you've got to be fucking kidding.
That would have been plausible, though.
Yeah. Right?
That can't be in that film.
Yeah. And then Knight is like, oh, how about I do the worst ever time appearing in one of my own films, like the worst. How about I do that? Like, pick a role and just make it awful.
And I feel bad for the daughter, because she's a musician in real life, mm-hmm. I guess. Mm-hmm. And she's okay, not my thing, but fine. But she is such a bad actress. Like, she literally looks like a deer in headlights the entire time. Her eyes just get big when she's like scared, and that's her. That's all she does. Like,
she tanks the third act. She tanks the third act.
I mean, and then, come on. The movie takes the third act.
No, yeah, for sure. Bad. She tanks it. And then they're like, you're like, oh, I don't know what can make this worse. And Alison Pill's like, have you ever seen me go really bad actress? Because I'll do it for the final scene.
I know. She's Alison fucking Pill. I don't get it.
So fucking bad.
Everybody is bad.
I'm also going to turn my daughter into Sherlock Holmes for no reason.
What the hell? Like, what the hell?
I don't know. It's
insane.
I mean, at this point, I mean, clearly he has to spend his own money to make movies, because there's no way anybody's going to give him money to make this mess. Like, I feel bad, because I'm like, I want him to be successful. He's made some movies that I like. And, you know, sometimes you have a couple of bad years, but like, I don't think he's had a good movie in what, like a decade?
No. And a scene like the first scene at the merch stand is an exact reason why. Where they have a thing where it's like, I wanted that shirt. I was here first. Oh, well, you're getting the last shirt. Well, you look like good people. I just saw you for about 2 seconds. You seem like the greatest people I've ever met. So come back to me and I'll get you a T-shirt. And you know what? We can walk in the back together because I trust you so much after this really incidental meeting.
Yeah.
M. Night is an alien. He doesn't know what human interaction has ever been. And he consistently shows that. He has zero clue. He has zero tact, zero idea of, I don't think he's ever talked to a person with for a real conversation.
So I'm guessing, Marina, you thought the exposition machine only had one scene. No, he has multiple scenes.
So many. Even and then they give him a stinger at the end of the movie too. Cause why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
It's so not good. I mean, I'm glad to have Josh Hartnett back. And if nothing else, the best part to come out of this movie is the fact that as the lead actor here, he's getting a lot of press and an opportunity like to talk. And it's been nice to hear him talk about his career and the choices that he's made. I honestly think that's the most interesting part of this entire release up until this point is that I want to say I'm done with Shyamalan. The problem is that every time he has a new movie, I'm like, but maybe this one will be good. It's like I can't help myself. It's horrible because I knew this was going to be bad. Like you guys had both said it was bad, and I still wanted to see it with my own eyes. Well, it was such a waste of 2 hours.
Is this
thing almost over? I'm like, there's still. How is this possible?
I will say two extra things about it before we move on. Is one from the cinematographer of Call Me by Your Name.
Why?
Yeah, I know. And two, it does have one of my favorite cuts of the year, which is him, Josh Hartnett and his daughter Riley, like looking to go back to the concert, like high five. They do their little handshake thing, and immediate cut to frenzy eyes in red filter. That really just happened.
And listen, Hamilton looks as shitty as I expect Hamilton to be. Okay, wow, I'm done.
That was sorry. Some shade.
We just lost all of our fans in Hamilton now. They're all
sorry, guys. Sorry. But really, we're that was supposed not... to pass as like a big concert hall, like a big like venue. It's like this looks like, you know, a third rate hockey.
It's the Cops Coliseum, y'all.
Yeah, well, no comment. Just skip. Do not make the mistake I made. Just fucking skip this one. Not worth the effort. Okay, who's next? Guys, Bill, Melissa, rescue us. You must have something good you've seen.
I'll go. I got a couple of good things. I finally saw Dee Dee.
I really want to see that. Me too.
Which is as good as everybody says it is. It's like a less cringy eighth grade, like, I felt sick after that film. I didn't feel sick after this one, but it's kind of the same premise. And it has, I was really, really, really good until the final scene. And then I cried like a baby. It's a super emotional film. It's incredibly well shot. And the acting is great from a bunch of teenagers who I'd never heard of. And they're, you know, you always have that problem of you might have bad children in acting. As I said before, I'm not really into children, which is terrible. But Joan Chen's in it, and she's classy as hell. Mm-hmm. And she's great. And this movie's got quite the punch, and they're screwing up the release on this one. Like this and Sing Sing, I've been waiting for this film for like 2 months. And I'll just talk about Sing Sing too. It's also really great. And Coleman Domingo, holy shit. He's gonna get it this year.
Yeah, they're saying that.
Yeah, he's incredible. And the film's really emotional. And just like you watch Ghostlight, another film about the power of performance. And I also cried maybe 7 times watching this film. It's pretty nuts. One of the better films of the year. Hopefully, but no, it's has not opened anywhere. It was, I think it was on 200 screens last week. It's been open for a month. Both of those films. They've ruined them. We talked about The Crow. It's really shitty. I saw The Killer. Did anybody watch The Killer?
No, it's on my list. I haven't watched it yet. Natalie Emmanuel.
It's a completely different film. Other than the fact
not a bad thing.
That it opens up with the woman getting blinded in the bar. That's the entire, like, nothing is the same.
Why did he call it The Killer?
I don't know. It's more like one of his older films. And has nothing to do with The Killer. It's more of a police procedural with Natalie Emmanuel being like a hired killer, and Omar Sy is like following her, trying to catch her. And it's not bad. I wanted to really hate this. It's not bad. It's actually pretty watchable. Natalie kicks a lot of ass, and she's really great at it. She uses a freaking sword. It's awesome. I wanted to kill this. I can't. It's good.
Wow.
So, yeah.
I like that. I like that.
Yeah.
It makes me feel better about watching it now.
It's not bad. And I saw a pre-release screening of Diner 89, this prequel to FUBAR. I thought it was really terrible. And I hate saying that because I want the film to do well. Because he, the guy who plays Diner was at the screening and he seemed like a really cool guy. He took a photo with everybody in the theater, and that takes a lot of patience.
Yeah, it does.
And that was pretty cool. But the movie's not good. It's just not funny. I didn't. It's lowest denominator humor. It's terrible.
That sucks.
But and he said in the Q&A, like, if nobody goes and see this movie first weekend, it will not be here anymore. So please tell all your friends. So I didn't like it, but go and see it because we need people to go and see Canadian films. So
yes, for sure.
But weren't you saying, Bill, that the audience was super into it? Like
they were.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were all. Let's just say that the theater sold alcohol, and
they were all Diner ready.
They were selling a lot of alcohol that night.
Yeah, they were Diner ready.
Yeah. As soon as the credits opened, I think I heard about 100 cans crack. So that was pretty interesting. The crowd loved it. So I'm just a bit of a film snob, so that might be it, but maybe you'll dig it.
But did anyone turn on their selfie cam and then their light to take selfies at the screening?
No, surprisingly, they were all hanging on the words of the Diner and didn't have time to TikTok.
I'm still waiting for my screener to get delivered to me. At first I had to sign off that I would not mention anything about FUBAR in my review ahead of it.
Yeah. So
supposedly Mongrel had to sign off. Everyone that Mongrel gives that out to has to be like, we do not talk about FUBAR. This is not a sequel. This is not a prequel. This is not FUBAR. Okay. Why do I have to have my hands up during this?
Because he only owns the rights to the one character.
Yeah.
That's what we were told. So he wasn't allowed to actually say the word FUBAR or talk about the other character.
Yeah. It just felt aggressive. Yeah. Like, okay, you can put the knife away.
And I also watched the first episode of the new Watchmen comic.
Oh, it's yes.
Really chapter rad.
And, it's so good.
It's so good.
Yeah, it's so good. I can't wait for chapter two. Yeah.
I'm glad because I have concerns.
It's a pretty straight adaptation.
Excellent.
I didn't mind the Zack Snyder version. I thought it was fine.
Yeah, I think it's one of his best.
One of his better films, yeah. But this feels way more complete. And if you're a fan of the original graphic novel, you will probably dig the hell out of this.
Yeah, I've been waiting for something like this, to be honest.
Yeah.
And it kind of ticked all the boxes for me.
Yeah, it's super good. And that's it for me.
Can I make a quick mention that I've seen the first 7 episodes of season 4 of Only Murders in the Building, and I still adore it so much. And now I have to wait till October for new stuff.
I haven't started, but we did start. I think that they've released everything they have on that 90s show on Netflix.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure the series is over. Yeah. So we've watched part 2. I really like that show. It's a lot of fun.
Volume 1 didn't have me really hugely, but in volume 2, I really like, I like, what's her name? Cassie Heverde, the one that plays Leia.
Yeah.
Her comedic timing is really, really good. And yeah. The show really starts to grow into its own in volume two. And then volume three is pretty solid.
I haven't seen volume three yet, but we've really enjoyed, we like that show. It's yeah. certainly better than that 80s show, which was unwatchable.
Three episodes, Glenn Howerton, Mitch Hedberg.
One episode was all we managed to get through before we're like, yeah, we're out.
It's bad.
Terminator Zero is pretty
funny. Yeah, I haven't started yet, but I want to.
Really, yeah. really good.
And if we're still talking TV, this just in, Industry is really good.
Industry is awesome. Industry is the best show nobody's watching.
I know.
And especially all those people that watched Alien Romulus, you can watch first two seasons and see David Johnson in just shake the screen.
Yeah.
I've
seen the first few episodes of season one and it didn't take me. So now I'm like, maybe I should rewatch this.
It's a burn. You got to get into these characters, into the motivations and stuff. I think that other shows on HBO just suck all the thunder away from this show, and the show deserves some eyes. So I think low key it has risen, especially with this third season now.
Yeah, because it's very, very buzzy at the moment. A lot of people are talking about it. And
Kit Harington being in it is a big deal now, too. So
True. Melissa, what do you have?
Okay, well, so I caught up on a lot of movies that you guys have already talked about in all of the podcasts that I've missed the recordings for. So I won't go into, too much on any of those. But, saw Twisters, liked it more than I thought, because I thought I was going to hate it. So that's not, it wasn't a very high bar. watched Hitman, which I adored. It was definitely my favorite of the bunch.
Oh, so you're a Glenn Powell fan. Welcome to the fan club.
Yeah. I mean, he's like one of those people where you look at him and you're like, oh, it's just too much. The dimples, the smile, the abs. Like, I want to not like you, but you make me like you anyway. you look at him and you're like, oh man, this guy looks like a frat bro kind of dude. But then he's not. He's kind of not. He's kind of got more depth than that, which is, it's a nice surprise. Anyway,
It's a douchey Stockholm syndrome.
It totally is.
Did you like the Steve and I both said that we hated the ending of Hitman, the test audience ending at the end where it's like a little chunk? Did you like that part?
That was unnecessary.
It's a completely different movie.
Yeah.
It's completely different.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah, I do agree. It didn't finish on the strongest note, but everything leading up to it was so charming and their chemistry was so great. Mm-hmm. It won me over in a big way. I also caught up with Maxine and Long Legs, both of which were disappointing in some ways for me. Maxine just went off the rails. Like, it started off so strong and then just completely lost me with the plot direction that they decided on, which was unfortunate because the 80s atmosphere and the soundtrack and everything, like the look of it was so great. Mia is such a phenomenal person to watch all the time. The dad thing, I was just like, what? Why? Why? Why did you go here? You know, like,
doesn't even make sense.
So that was a bit disappointing, but it's still kind of a fun ride. Long Legs, I think it was like the supernatural bit just kind of lost me. Like, it was really interesting to me when it was like a serial killer procedural. And then I think the supernatural bit just didn't entirely work for me. But it was so great at that, like, atmospheric tension. And Micah Monroe, I think, is just brilliant. I mean, Nicolas Cage was completely unhinged. But like, I can't see a guy like that, like, making his way through society without like a lot of people phoning the police on him. Do you know what I mean? Like,
the store girl, dad, the creepy guy's here again.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like, I don't know. I just feel like he would have been on a watch list somewhere. and then what else did I catch up with? maybe that's it for like the newer movies. And then I've been on like an older movie kick a lot recently. So the Cinematheque here in Vancouver has been doing a great retrospective on Godard movies, which I love, even though like I'm not going to pretend that I understand Godard films. but
at least
I do
you're
like
giving them, at least you're giving them the option. Like I've decided I don't like Godard, and I just haven't bothered to watch anything else other than what the two or three movies that I've seen. I just can't be bothered at this point.
Okay. Well, the thing is, so there's a couple of his films that I really like adore. Like I love Weekend. Like I love that movie so much. It's so like off the rails, unhinged. And just has like the greatest dolly shot in all of cinematic history. But the two movies that I caught up with more recently were Bande à Part and Pierrot le Fou, both of which are worth watching because Anna Karina is in them. And Anna Karina is like, God, she has to be like one of the most luminous actresses ever to be on screen. Like she's just so compelling. Like it doesn't even matter what she's doing or what her dialogue is. There's just something about her that is like infinitely, infinitely watchable to me. So I thought like those two movies were really great to see. And the Bande à Part, the dance scene in the cafe is so classic for a reason. Like it's just so charming. And it's a movie about anti-heroes that are plotting like a robbery. Mm-hmm. But there's this like wonderful little dance break in the middle of the film. And it's so utterly charming and perfect. I don't know how else to explain it. I've also been recently just finished reading Quentin Tarantino's Cinema Spectacular, which is a really great read, by the way. Like if you are at all interested in cinema or Quentin Tarantino, it is definitely a super interesting book to read. It's basically him chronicling all the movies that he watched at probably inappropriate ages. Like his parents started taking him, his mom started taking him to the theater when he was like age six and seeing like a lot of the 70s, like he went to see Last House on the Left when he was like a kid. That's probably not good. But like you kind of get a way better sense of like where all of his sensibilities came from, because he's been like a giant movie nerd since the age of six. And so reading this book and reading like about various movies that were meaningful or impactful to him as a kid watching them in the 70s was really interesting. I don't agree with every single take he has on all of these films. I especially don't necessarily subscribe to his take on Taxi Driver, but it was really interesting to read like his assessment of all of these films. And then I ended up watching Rolling Thunder, which was on Amazon Prime, but it's like a movie from 1977, I think, with William Devane and a very, very young Tommy Lee Jones. and it's like it was a Paul Schrader script. But Schrader got like kind of kicked off the movie at some point, and so it became something else entirely. And it's basically about a Vietnam vet who comes home after being in a POW camp for 7 years. And he gets gifted like $2,500 in silver dollars, and this gang shows up to steal it. And he won't tell them where it is because he's so accustomed to surviving torture that he doesn't feel the need to give this up. And in the process loses, like they kill his entire family. And then he goes on a massive revenge spree. So first they cut off his hand in a garbage, in a trash compactor. And then he has a hook hand for the rest of the film. So like this is the movie. It's crazy. Devane gives like the most like emotionally stunted performance ever. It's actually really great. Like everything is internal. He has very little dialogue in the film, but yeah, it's pretty great. And there's the supporting female character, Linda Haynes. I think this might have been her only movie, or she might have done two. She was phenomenal. I don't know what happened to her. She was really great. She was like one of my favorite parts of the film. But yeah, it's crazy. It's an insane revenge pick. I understand why Tarantino appreciated it and how it was inspirational to him. So if you're really into genre movies and you want to catch up with that one, it was a fun ride. I enjoyed watching it.
So you're telling me that I'm basically preparing my 8-year-old niece to be the greatest, one of the greatest directors in Hollywood in 25 years. Because her parents decided at some point, somebody decided to show her Alien. And I'm like, okay, this opens the door for me to show her all the shit I like. So yes, she's being schooled and she's 8. And somebody, my mom said to me the other day, is this why Chloe can't sleep at night? I'm like, maybe. It wasn't my fault. I'm not the one that showed her Alien and Aliens at 8. So don't come at me. Come at our parents.
My brother and I, it was the same thing. Like, my dad did not really censor what he watched just because we were around.
Yeah, right? Well, she did say to me the other day, well, she's a big Beetlejuice fan, so we're going to go take her to see Beetlejuice this week. But she was watching some crap, I think Outer Banks. And I'm like, why are you watching this crap? You should watch something different. So she was watching The Maze Runner. I'm like, you know what? We need to watch The 100.
No, you don't. Oh.
Yes, yes, you fucking do.
Maybe the first two glorious seasons.
8 seasons of it. So this is happening. This is now our evening watches. When she's here, we watch an episode of The 100.
it's cinema spectacular. I really recommend it as a book. I read it pretty quickly just because it was really fascinating. Like, it's a mix of learning more about Quentin's background and what like really got him going in terms of movies. And then also just like his take on all these, like some of them are slightly obscure movies from the 70s and others are pretty well known, like Taxi Driver, obviously. But yeah, it's just a really interesting read from someone who, aside from being a pretty terrific filmmaker, is also a humongous cinema nerd. So, yeah.
I know you didn't say it, but I'm guessing he slams Taxi Driver.
No, he doesn't slam Taxi Driver.
Okay. I was going to be really angry if he did. I love Taxi Driver.
No, absolutely. Okay. He doesn't. No.
Okay.
It's more interpretation of certain things. It's not my interpretation of the movie, but I also watched the movie not when it was released. So yeah.
I would love for more filmmakers to kind of talk about their inspiration more openly. Because I mean, the other person that I'd love to see a book like that from is Steven Soderbergh, because he watches like the stuff that he watches. I'm like, okay, so what exactly did you think about it? So I love seeing his like end of year list where he lists everything he's seen and watched over the read and seen over the course of the year. And I was like, what did you think of that? That's always my key thing is like, so what did you think of that? And he doesn't really talk about it. So it'd be
great. Yeah, I'd like Sean Baker to do that too. Because I follow him on Letterboxd and he always logs everything that he sees, but he doesn't write reviews.
Exactly.
Or, like, give star ratings or anything, which I completely understand. Like, if I were him, I wouldn't do that either. But I would love to know, like even, you know, his top 20 or like something, you know, like his inspirational films. Cause I just think it would be interesting. He'd be an interesting guy.
Agreed. Okay. So what's coming, Bill? What are our choices for our next movie of the week?
So once again, I said too many last episode. So we talked about Beetlejuice last episode, but it opens next week.
Yep.
Beetlejuice. Anybody not want to do that one?
Yeah. I just don't know if there's going to be enough to talk about. Like, the reviews have been quite favorable coming out of Venice, but I mean, nothing that I think would, I don't think it's going to be like a movie that's going to require, you know, a long discussion.
Yeah.
Is my feeling.
Well, I'll say the rest of them just so we can pick. Front Room, Steve already talked about it. Mm-hmm. It's written by the Eggers brothers. Yes, there's brothers. Rebel Ridge, which I think would be pretty cool if we did that one, maybe.
Saulnier.
I think Saulnier is awesome. Or if you want to talk about Red Rooms for the 48th time.
I am always up talking about Red Rooms. Another excuse to watch that movie yet again. I've seen it 3 times. I just looked on Letterboxd and I'm like, Jesus, it does not feel like I've seen it 3 times.
Okay, so on September 13th, new Kevin Smith movie, the 4:30 movie.
No, thanks.
I don't think that's opening anywhere near here other than Rio for one show.
Does anybody care? Is the other question.
I do, but we'll
I'd see this one. I'm not down for another Clerks movie, but I'd definitely go see this one.
I'm a Kevin Smith lifelong. So
I've checked out officially.
Did anybody see the original Speak No Evil?
Yep.
That's badass. Yep.
And it's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah. I don't know if this new one is going to get as dark as that ending is.
Yeah. But everybody,
I'm wondering.
Everybody who's seen it says McAvoy is on another level. So I
internet wait. Already hates it.
Really?
Wait, internet it's a remake?
Already hates it.
Yeah, it's a remake.
It's a remake of a Danish film. Yeah. The internet the internet already hates it. They're already pulling apart the trailer, saying that McAvoy's given the worst facial acting they've ever seen in their entire lives. Like they're adamant to tank this movie before it came out. I don't know why. I really don't know why.
I think this trailer is great, and this casting is chef's kiss.
And let's remember it's directed by James Watkins, and James Watkins arrived on the scene with Eden Lake.
Yeah.
Which has one of the most bleak endings ever.
Yeah, it's a pretty damn good movie. I am A-okay to see this.
Yeah,
and,
me too.
And for all you Halt and Catch Fire stands,
right?
Scoot
and Mackenzie Davis are both in it. So that's
both of them.
Casting to have them together. Like that is so I watched that trailer and I'm like, this is so weird.
It's really strange.
But any love for that series. That series is so good.
He's working so hard to make up for being in Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice, and I appreciate him for that. He's just working overtime, being like that. I was never in a wheelchair doing weird acrobatic stuff around a statue in that movie. What are you talking about? Like, yeah, no, that was somebody looked like you. It wasn't you.
Not a lot opening, but there's one more, and the title alone makes it so it won't open wide. My Old Ass.
Yes, I just saw the trailer, actually. The trailer
which is great. So great.
It's really solid. It's really solid. Yeah. I want to love this one. I feel like I'm going to love this one. It's got like a Babes quality to me.
This concept is just genius.
Yeah, it's bonkers.
It's such a great concept. Like, give me a time travel movie. But one that actually, I want to live this experience.
And what future is she in? Because that's really intriguing, too.
Yeah. Right?
What is going on? They have to go into a bomb shelter? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah. Like, it's just that trailer is so good. Mm-hmm, so good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, yeah, so I'm guessing it's either going to be Beetlejuice, Rebel Ridge, or Speak No Evil.
Yeah, we got a few options.
Yeah,
it's good to have some more options.
And if we want to, My Old Ass, but I don't think Steve's going
to
see it.
I don't know if I'll be able to get that one. Yeah, unless they hook me up.
Yeah. Well, we'll figure it out.
I guess folks will just have to tune in next week, in 2 weeks, to figure out what exactly we're going to talk about. Because we don't even know at this
point. Red rooms.
I'm all up for it.
Red rooms anyway, but
yeah, I am A-okay with that. Any reason, like I need a reason to rewatch that movie. Honestly, at this point, let's just throw it in. It's okay.
But how fun of a double bill would that be? Like Red Rooms and Strange Darling.
really good. Really good. Oh, Red Rooms is just so spectacular. I fucking love that. Okay, so where can folks find you?
I am Bill Harris. I am on Letterboxd and Twitter at SoundJam69. Liverpool beat Man U today, so I'm in mourning. And that's about it. Thank you.
I was wearing the wrong color of papaya today. I was wearing the wrong color of orange. I wasn't even wearing orange, but, you know, if you're an F1 fan, you know. When you know, you know. You can find me on Letterboxd at the Marina 2, and that's pretty much the only place you can find me at this point. And Melissa,
that's right. We gotta save the professional for last. You can find me on Letterboxd at Melzy Melzy as well. Although I have not been as prolific there as I sometimes am, but you can read my full review of Rolling Thunder on there if you are so inclined. Over to you, professional.
You can find me on Letterboxd, Threads, Instagram, and Twitter at The Steve Will Dead. You can find my website, stevestebbing.ca. I do a show on there every week at 9 a.m. Pacific time every Friday with my daughter Chloe called What the Hell Should I Watch? We're actually, as a film reviewing duo, making our debut at the Vancouver International Film Festival this year, reviewing it. My ninth year, her first year, so she's jacked for this. Like, we're both super excited to tackle this one together. I'm also on Tremble, the horror pod, with Kurt and Taylor. The last episodes we did was Phantom of the Mall, Eric's Revenge, which is what the fuck, this movie, holy shit. And Popcorn from 1991. Nice. Which is a great horror movie that takes place at a movie theater. And you think more horror movies would take place at movie theaters, just to be meta. And it was a lot more fun than I remembered. And I'm also on the Shane Hewitt and the Night Shift, which is on the iHeartRadio network, emanating from Toronto's News 1010. And then it gets rebroadcast over the weekend. The initial broadcast is Friday at 8 p.m. Eastern time. You can just go on the internet and put the widget on your screen and listen to that. And yeah, that's it for me.
And you can find links to all of the show notes for everything we've talked about today at atcpod.ca. Until the next time.
Hack the planet.